Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to the Geneva Business Insider, that monthly series where we talk to our good friend David L. Smith of the Geneva Business Insider blog about everything that's happening around the world in politics and economics and other aspects of the world order besides. It's always a fascinating discussion, so of course you can find previous editions of this interview series on our YouTube channel and on CorbettReport.com itself, but let's get into today's conversation. David Smith, thank you again for your time.
Good to be back again, James. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, there's always too much to talk about going on in the world, but why don't we turn today to start by looking at a section of the world that you're very familiar with, Scotland. And, of course, everyone is looking anxiously or in anticipation or at any rate is looking at Scotland in the coming week where, of course, the Scottish referendum will be deciding whether or not Scotland moves towards separation from the United Kingdom in whatever form that may or may not be, that may or may not take. So just a roundup of some of the headlines and some of the ways this is being covered in the media. For example, the Guardian today is reporting Scottish referendum polls may be too close to call, but the trend is towards yes. Newsweek notes that the UK Ministry of Defence has, quote, no contingency plan for the Scottish referendum split. The Telegraph is reporting that one of Britain's fastest-growing wealth managers, Nutmeg, has switched £50 million of British savings into US investments in anticipation, or at least in perhaps in fear, of what may be coming. My home and native lands national newspaper, The Globe and Mail, talks about the Scottish referendum as the world's first vote on economic and political inequality, noting that, quote, London, they would argue, the Scottish would argue, effectively seceded from the UK during the Thatcher Revolution of the 1980s, leaving the rest of the country deindustrialized. Employment in shipbuilding, steel, and other basic manufacturing sectors was decimated in Scotland during the Thatcher years. Once the workshop of the world, Britain has become an enormous net importer of manufactured goods, leaving the financial sector to keep the country solvent. End quote. An interesting take, and perhaps one that plays very much into the feeling of isolation and neglect that the Scottish people have obviously been suffering for a very long time, but acutely so since that Thatcher era. Obviously, a lot of different takes on what's happening in Scotland, but David Smith, I'm very much interested in your take and what you make of the surge in the polls for the yes side and the fact that it very much does look like the momentum is on the yes side side of the ledger at this point.
Well, we did some months back a kind of light-hearted look at the Scottish situation when this trend was not really very obvious. And it has been a very short-term and recent trend. But underlying all of this, I think there is a profound disillusionment by everybody with the political elites which are running the world at the moment. And Scotland has sufficient of an identity to be able to stand up and say, well, We are a Scottish, in inverted commas, nation. We have shared values, and we can make a go of it. Now, I think the comments that you read out before, this is really a vote. Indeed, this is a vote on a kind of secession from the discriminatory policies that are applied. Scotland is pretty much as you describe it. It used to be a tremendous industrial nation. They had huge ports, huge fishing. They had manufacturing and large scales, they had shipbuilding. They had all kinds of activities like this. And of course, the industrialization has indeed taken place. On the other hand, yes, we have the banking sector, which is meant to be taking the banking services taking place of the rest. But as we all know, hidden behind the banking sector at the moment are hundreds of billions, if not more, of undisclosed losses. And the wealth of the banking sector is achieved simply by by pumping up asset values and not really creating anything and allowing the structure to pay people huge and enormous bonuses. So it is a fudged economy. There is nothing real about it. And the Scots, I think, have every right to express a point of view and have a vote on it. You mentioned the military having no alternatives to the existing structure because the nuclear submarine capabilities are, in fact, in in a place called Faslane, which is near to Glasgow. It is an employer, it is a reasonably significant employer, but it employs a few thousand people, and there are many millions in Scotland, so the implications for employment are very localized and could be cured by just an extremely modest amount of growth or some kind of reindustrialization of the area. And the other aspect of it, of course, is all doom, gloom, disaster, and the British establishment now got their backs to the wall, and whenever they have their backs to the wall, they pull out all the cards of lies and deceptions and over-dramatizations of things which which are problems, yes, but are completely surmountable. And if you look at the Faslane situation, one can only start and compare it perhaps to the Ukraine and Crimea, in the sense that the Russians had a port in Sebastopol, which they were very keen to hang on to as part of their global greater defense system. But of course, that's completely unacceptable. But on the other hand, in Scotland, you know, the world is going to fall apart, and the UK is going to be completely insecure if Scotland ceases to be part of the UK. So the whole thing is propagandized to a point which is ridiculous. And the Scots have one very good quality. You know, they see through all of this. There are people who, there's an old saying from an old Scottish peasant saying, you know, is never believe what you hear and only believe half of what you see. So when I see a gang of idiots like Cameron and Miliband and Clegg deigning to travel north into that unknown area where the only parts they know of it are the shooting and hunting states of their friends, then I think their chances of scoring a success, I mean, they are the greatest tool that Salmond has in his tool bag for ensuring a yes vote.
It strikes me, and again, I'm completely detached from this, so I'm just looking at it from the outside, but it strikes me that this is much more of a no vote to Westminster than it is a yes vote to Scottish independence. At least, well, I there are different aspects to that, but it certainly does seem, as you, I think you're positing here, that it is more about rejecting the insanity of the current UK government than it is necessarily about what they people are expecting on the other side of this.
I think that's right. I mean, if we look at the UK has got a reasonably organised movement in the form of Mr. Nigel Farage with the UKIP, the UK Independence Party. And he basically is one level up the food chain saying exactly the same thing. He's saying, you know, we are owned and controlled by Brussels. We have little capacity to influence what they do. And the best thing that we can do is make sure that we're independent of this, so that we decide our own fate. Now, what is happening in Scotland is exactly the same thing. People say we have an identity. We want to establish, re-establish that identity and live our own lives, which is totally reasonable. And it also has the aspect of an emotional appeal, which is particularly strong amongst the young, but not uniquely. I mean, I see my family are still there, with a range from my mother, who's in her 90s, down to my nephews and nieces, who are in their teens and 20s. But there is immense disillusionment with the political system and a kind of questioning, saying, is this the way out? Is this the right thing to do? If the UK had been run even slightly correctly for the last, goodness me, since the post-Thatcher times, it has not been, you know, this issue would not arise. And we Scotland has produced some of the most talented people in the world, who've had the greatest impact on the world, who've gone everywhere, invented things, built things, created huge cities, empires, the whole lot. And what we have now is a whimpering bunch of idiots in the UK, in London in particular. And our final embarrassment, of course, was our good friend Mr. Gordon Brown, who is also apparently going to pick up his banner and start walking around Scotland convincing people that we should stay with the UK. Now, once again, I think the great relief of the Scottish people was the fact that he was Prime Minister of the UK, because otherwise he might have tried to make a political career in Scotland, which would have been the ultimate nightmare.
Yes, when it comes to much-loved politicians, I don't believe Gordon Brown is up there. So it is kind of humorous to see the people who are attempting now to woo Scotland back into the fold. But and I think you're right. I mean, this is obviously a laudable idea, and it does speak to the decentralization that I often talk about as the only possible solution going forward to try to get ourselves out of this system. And there are many laudable things about that. But of course, as we talked about in our previous conversation about this referendum, the devil is in the details, and what details are being planned for this. It's still not very clear to me exactly what this ultimately will mean if there is a yes vote in terms of the actual details of what powers the Scottish government will take over from Westminster. But I did note this, which very much speaks to my own concerns about what may be actually happening here. From BBC, Scottish independence. Yes vote means big Scots EU boost. Scottish independence would give the nation's profile its biggest ever boost in Europe, First Minister Alex Salmond has said. Ahead of the 18th of September referendum, Mr. Salmond said a Westminster elite was jeopardizing Scotland's EU future. SNP ministers said an independent Scotland could negotiate EU membership within an 18-month timescale. However, campaigners for the union said nobody could trust a word Mr. Salmond had to say on Europe. Mr. Salmond, who was campaigning in Edinburgh's Parliament Square, home to the old Scottish Parliament, hit out at Prime Minister David Cameron's offer of an in-out EU referendum if the Conservatives win the next election. At a time when Scotland's European future is being placed in jeopardy by a Westminster elite obsessed by UKIP, it is becoming ever clearer that Scotland's European policy is best decided by people in Scotland, said the First Minister. Well, I think it should be decided by people in Scotland, but it very much worries me that this is being posited as some sort of wonderful thing that we must struggle to get into the EU as quickly as possible and assure our place in that European Union pecking order, because apparently people still believe that European Union membership is vital to their national interests. That kind of boggles my mind, and to my mind, it raises serious questions about the people who are actually steering Scotland into perhaps just another iceberg.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, anyone who wants to join the EU at this particular time is nothing short of a mindless moron. I mean, there are so many other things. Independence should mean independence. It should mean independence from bureaucrats who control our destiny. And we should not be running in there like, I don't know. I mean, the two things that shock me completely are this kind of desire for affiliation and people who rush to try and get the money into some of the most corrupt banks in the world. You know, here we are looking at people trying to join the most corrupt and incompetent bureaucracy in the world. And that is, there's a lot of competition there, but I think the EU probably wins it. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that if you are a country and you are producing goods that people want, and they want to buy it. It doesn't matter what your currency is or anything else. They will come and they will buy. And it's as simple as that. And you have Iceland, you know, they're an independent country. There are 300,000 or 400,000 people there. It's tiny. They have their own currency. Yet for some reason, we don't seem to be able to admit that Scotland could be independent and have its own currency. You're also hearing lovely stories about, oh, you must have a central bank. Well, I mean, as we both know, I mean, the purpose of a central bank is that you sell out to the establishment and you're under someone else's control while you give the population the impression that they have elected to be free. You've sold your birthright down the line straight away. So, I mean, all of the things that they're in a big rush to try and do are actually destructive to the concept of being free. And you know, you look at the military and you hear these wonderful stories about how, you know, Scotland not being part of NATO not being part of the UK will suddenly open up enormous security risks for the UK. Well, all I can say is let's open them up, because the sooner we become a kind of, you know, like a Switzerland, which is not fully where I live, which is not fully integrated into the EU system. They manage to have their own independent army, their defense system, and they actually use the word defense because that's what it is. They stay within their own borders instead of this kind of rapacious international thuggery, which is used to asset strip countries that stand up against the establishment, etc. So I can see only advantages from withdrawing from that. Yes, let's lease the UK Faslane. I think would be a good idea. Why not? That's what the Russians did in Sevastopol. It worked perfectly well, and there was a pretty substantial amount of money flowed into the Ukrainian economy in terms of hard cash and in terms of jobs. So why not do that? There are so many things that are presented as insurmountable problems in this story, which in fact are not problems at all. You know, again, we take the example of Ukraine. Russia managed almost immediately to replace the hryvnia, I think the name of the currency is there, with the ruble. We haven't heard of the whole world coming to an end in Ukraine. I had a lunch earlier this week with someone who's got who's married to a Russian and who's got an apartment in Yalta. They were down there on holiday and had a very pleasant time. So all of the stories that they're telling you is just propagandized, elitist rubbish, which is designed to panic people into voting for the status quo. And if you are given an opportunity not to vote for the status quo, you should think very seriously about it. There's my rough take.
Well, I concur wholeheartedly. And I guess by the time we talk next, there will be a decision one way or another in terms of yes or no. And I suppose we can look at how that actually falls out at that point. And again, the devil is in the details. And I shudder to think of a Scotland that votes for independence and then immediately joins the EU, signs up to NATO and continues with the status quo and establishes a central bank. I mean, what would be the point of that? But hopefully the Scottish people will be able to push this through to some sort of resolution. At any rate, we will see how this plays out. And as I say, that vote will be taking place on the 18th of September. But let's turn our attention eastward. You raised the Ukrainian specter. So this is something we've been covering for months here on this program. Why don't we continue to cover it as, of course, recently Russia and Ukraine and the rebels have reached some sort of ceasefire, although it's a questionable to what extent the ceasefire has actually taken hold. For example, Reuters reporting today, Ukraine death toll edges up despite ceasefire, more POWs freed, noting that 5 Ukrainian servicemen have been killed in the past 4 days, according to the Ukrainian military, underscoring the strains in a ceasefire between government forces and pro-Russian separatists that officials insist is still broadly holding. So, at any rate, there has been a great reduction in the immediate military tensions there, but of course the underlying issues of this these tensions remain, and I don't see that going away anytime in the near future. What is the ultimate effect of this ceasefire? Is this an important step along the path towards some sort of resolution to this, or is this just a holding pattern while forces regroup for the next round of fighting?
Well, I'm not a military expert, but I mean, the logic of the situation is that everyone needed a breather and to think about what to do next. Everyone is billing the ceasefire as a win for Putin. Maybe it is, but, you know, there are so many innocent people getting killed in this. There is no genuine coverage by the Western media of what is actually happening in these regions in eastern Ukraine. There is no water, there's no electricity, people are dying in the streets, there's no medication. But that's all perfectly all right, so long as it's been done in the name of freedom and democracy. But the more honest coverage, not that I'm saying it's completely honest, but the more honest coverage, I think, is coming from Russia today, where they actually show some of the things that are going on. And the other thing that I think is very significant is that, again, if I link the Ukraine back to Scotland, there was a famous massacre in Glencoe several hundred years ago, which is still part of Scottish culture and heritage and clan warfare, etc. And this is exactly what the West has created now in the east of the Ukraine. If you can imagine, you know, the people in, you're a Canadian, let's say the people in Quebec coming and starting to bomb Toronto, how long would it be before the people there formed their own militia to force them out? And how long would it take for those people to forget what had happened and trust the person sitting opposite them who a week ago was bombing them until they managed to find a big brother strong enough to stop the bombing, either through political means or perhaps through covert military support? I mean, the alternative is that they would just have continued to bomb the city until it ended up like another Grozny. So we have, the US, as always, playing the angel in the game and propping up the most horrendous brutality on the citizenry of a country in which they have absolutely no strategic interest. Maybe I should correct that. They have a strategic interest, if you call it monetary interest, where they feel that anywhere in the world where there is oil and gas, that is a strategic interest for America and for American corporations. And just to prove the point, we now find that in Ukraine, the biggest gas company in eastern Ukraine has a board member whose name is Hunter Biden, none other than the son of Joe Biden. But once again, the American administration finds that there's no possible conflict in that. And of course, Mr. Biden is the best possible choice for the job, only on his own merits.
Indeed. Well, yeah. And of course, let's not forget Royal Dutch Shell, which, as I pointed out in my recent podcast on the MH17 subject, has a $10 billion investment in gas fields, including one that is just north of the MH17 crash site. An interesting little part of that story that went under the radar. But regarding your Canadian analogy, I think I'm culturally obligated as an Albertan to say that if Ontarians and Quebecers got into some sort of war that wiped each other out, that would be no great loss to the nation. But perhaps that's my biased Western perspective. Of course, just a joke. But
best mountains and ski slopes.
Just a joke, of course. But yes, I think absolutely this is something that has to be seen in terms of the manipulations and machinations of the outside powers that have been using Ukraine like a ping pong ball. And unfortunately, that aspect of this is not going to go away, and I think that's going to only in the long run exacerbate the situation. And some inkling of that can be garnered from a New York Times report that was put up earlier today. Amid intensifying requests, American military aid to Ukraine stalls. And this article goes on to lament the fact that the promised United States military aid package of $70 million of various types of equipment and supplies that had been promised to the Ukrainian government so far have failed to get through the pipeline, and a Ukraine National Guard training program that the United States military is scheduled to engage in, training 700 members of the National Guard, is not scheduled to start until 2015. And basically the gist of this article is, you know, it's such a terrible thing. Ukraine's falling apart and the U.S. isn't stepping up to the plate and delivering enough aid quickly enough. So, of course, they're trying to put it into that particular propaganda narrative. What do you say about the way that the outside powers are manipulating what's happening inside Ukraine?
Well, I mean, the direct or indirect effect of America and NATO is basically to militarize the world, and that serves the interests of the military-industrial complex in the States. It serves probably the interests of the oil and gas companies. And it serves the interests of, you know, infrastructure companies and et cetera, because once you bomb something, then you have to build it up again. So you give them a loan, rebuild it using your own resources, and then the country is indebted to you. Then after that, the next step is to say, well, you can't afford to pay the debts, so we're going to privatize and steal some more of the country's assets. So it's all just a well-established American business model. When you look at the Ukraine and you talk about $70 million, I mean, $70 million in a military context is less than buttons. I mean, if you take the cost of an aircraft, it's two fighter aircraft. It is, three or four tanks. You know, it's not even one landing ship, et cetera, et cetera. So if they are giving $70 million, I mean, basically what they're going to be doing is they're going to be giving people the equivalent of AK-47s to go around and kill each other on the spot. You know, those kind of weapons are relatively cheap, freely available, and they can cause terrible damage on the civilian population.
Right. To be clear, I should stipulate that the aid is not in arms, but is scheduled to be rations, radios, concertina wire, first aid kits, limited supplies of body armor, but no arms specifically.
Well, this sounds a little bit like Russia's white lorry aid convoy, which, of course, the West treated as being a Trojan horse. Well, I mean, shouldn't everyone in the world be saying, well, here's a Trojan horse coming from the other side of the world now? I mean, who is doing the examination of the kit that's landing in the country, for example? Is it being inspected by the OSCE observers, or is this just stuff that's landing in a military base somewhere in the west of Ukraine, where the government just quietly puts it wherever it wants to put it, while telling the public that it's made up of all kinds of nice, fuzzy defensive stuff? I really don't know, but I don't trust or believe a word that these guys say.
Well, I think that's generally a good way to approach these types of stories. So again, it's going to be interesting to see how this develops, and I certainly don't think we've heard the last of this situation, although we may have heard the last of it to be covered in the mainstream media in sort of the way they've been covering it hitherto. It may be, at this point, it goes more under the mainstream media radar. But at any rate, I don't think the underlying tensions have been resolved, and I think there's going to be probably more fighting in the near future. But we'll, again, have to see how that plays out. And on the Ukrainian note, while we're on it, I think we should note that the Dutch investigation into the MH17 crash has come out with its initial report saying that the airliner was downed by, quote, high energy objects, end quote, which they are saying is very completely 100% in keeping with the idea that it was brought down by an SA-11 delivered by a Buk missile system. Insofar as those missiles are intended to explode a slight distance from the aircraft, and the shrapnel then brings down the aircraft. That's what they're at least attempting to say. And anyone who might be able to say very specifically otherwise, i.e. the Russians themselves, have apparently not responded in a very thoroughgoing manner to this report, at least at this time. And the Russians merely saying that the report leaves more questions than answers. But it seems that whatever the Russians do know from their own telemetry and radar data and all of that, they're probably not going to put that on the table at this point. And I wonder if that is related, as one of the commenters, Green Crow, in the CorbettReport.com comment section noted, whether this is related to the ceasefire in Ukraine, and whether there's some under the table arrangement of don't squeal about this, and we'll ease the tension kind of thing. Anyway, a lot of speculation there, but something to keep in mind. Unless you had anything to add to the MH17 side of this.
Yeah, well, not so much, because we're so deprived of facts. It's difficult, but there is an extraordinary pact between the countries involved of complete confidentiality on the actual outcome of the report. So. It would mean that, if I remember correctly, Ukraine, Malaysia, Holland, and I think perhaps the US have a pact of confidentiality that unless all four of them agree to have the results of this crash disclosed, it will not take place. So what it is, if you think about it, is that basically these countries are giving themselves the right to accept that several hundred citizens have been killed, murdered, and that the governments are not accountable to the population of their own countries or the world to account for exactly how that happened or why, and that the people who actually do the investigation, if they're not muzzled at the first level, which is by being told, this is a report, otherwise you lose your job, the kind of 9/11 model, it is, even if they do write an honest report, that all it's going to do is gather dust in some, inspector's, aircraft investigation accident board safe for 50 or 100 years. Maybe there's more to it. I mean, one of the arguments that the plane was shot down by a Ukrainian Su-25 fighter is a possibility, but it's complicated. I used to be a pilot, so I know a little about it, but it is complicated because the Su-25 normally does not have oxygen, and it operates at lower levels, and its performance is not so different from the jets. So how it caught it up, how it intercepted it, all these kind of things would be logistically immensely difficult. Unless, of course, the jet was, for example, told to descend to 20,000 feet and slow down to this speed, and in which case it would all be possible. But as the airline, you know, as air traffic control communications have all been suppressed as well, who knows what actually happened? And I think this will, it's all just part of a very nice package. And certainly Putin knows a lot more about it than he is saying. And it may be, you know, the death of these several hundred people is maybe just a negotiating card in a very, very dirty game of global poker.
Unfortunately, I suspect you're correct. And as tragic as that is, I think we should keep in mind that there are sometimes much, much greater tragedies that are also just playing cards in this game of poker. So nothing new there specifically. Thank you for reminding us about that non-disclosure agreement. Just for the record, the four countries involved in that agreement, the Ukraine, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Australia, who agreed that if there, if any one of those parties did not agree with the ultimate results of the investigation, they could veto the publication of that investigation. So whatever truth, whatever report we end up getting, it will be the officially sanctioned quote-unquote truth of those four parties. So just something to keep in mind, and just another example of how we are not given the full picture. And I guess let's move on to our final part of the today's conversation, talking about another, well, a related aspect of the crisis, the tensions between the West and Russia. And I'm going to turn our attention to a story that took place a couple of weeks ago, but has already been sort of memory-holed, or at any rate, it's not being talked about very much. The hacking of JP Morgan Chase & Co. and, quote-unquote, at least four other banks, which, interestingly enough, is not mentioned in the report that I'm looking at, but the hacking of these banks that resulted in the loss of gigabytes of customer data, and apparently penetrated down to the level where that data could have been deleted and or altered if the hackers had wished, although there was no signs that that actually took place. Obviously, a very, very severe breach of an institution that we have been taught to believe is a safe vault-like place where we can put our money. And of course, there are many things wrong with that conception. One of them being that it is, of course, not safe and secure in this age of hacking. And in the age of cyber, virtual false flag terrorism, which I think is an interesting possibility when it comes to these hacking events, that we just have to take the word of the authorities. Oh, it was Russian hackers. How do they know this? Well, who knows? And how do we have any way of verifying that? Well, we don't. But as interesting as that story was, I want to actually take a look at a Bloomberg story that came out the next day on August 29th, August 30th, that was absolutely fascinating, talking about the cyber terror bank bailout. They're already talking about it, and you may be on the hook. And this story says, quote, "Bankers and U.S. officials have warned that cyber terrorists will try to wreck the financial system's computer networks. What they aren't saying publicly is that taxpayers will probably have to cover much of that damage. Even if customers don't lose money from a hacking assault on JP Morgan Chase & Co., the episode is a reminder that banks with the most sophisticated defenses are vulnerable. Treasury Department officials have quietly told bank insurers that in the event of a cataclysmic attack, they would activate a government backstop that doesn't explicitly cover electronic intrusions, two people briefed on the talk said. I can foresee a situation where the president wouldn't do something via executive order, said Edward DeMarco, general counsel of the Risk Management Association, a professional group of the banking industry. All we're talking about is the difference between the destruction of tangible property and intangible property." End quote. And I encourage people to read through the rest of this, but the long story short is that the traditional ways that banks are insured by the FDIC covers various types of situations like bank runs, but does not cover the idea of an electronic intrusion, so that the people would potentially be on the hook for this unless there was a bank bailout that would be eventuated by other means. And who would be on the hook for that? Well, of course, it's the taxpayer. So this is another interesting little idea that they've just seeded in all of this hacking hysteria that's gone on in the buildup towards whatever cyber event we're looking forward to in the next, in the coming years. David Smith, your take on this story and what it says to us about the financial institutions and about the propensity for government to be nothing other than a basically a big bank vault for the banks to draw on whenever they need to, backed up, of course, by the taxpayers.
Well, that is exactly what it is, unfortunately. I mean, if you take it down to the lowest level, if your computer gets hacked and you lose all of your data, you're 100% responsible for the losses. you can perhaps take out an insurance. And undoubtedly for my my MacBook Pro, I could probably get reimbursed even by AIG. However, if the thing's on a much bigger scale, AIG may not be able to bear the risk, and then all of a sudden it's a taxpayer again. But by what right? I mean, did you ever vote on legislation that says, you know, we agreed to bail out so much? You know, if the bank loses cash, there is an upward limit on the cash they have to pay, there is an upward limit, you know, and the FDIC is there to provide support, but the FDIC's total capital is just a few billion. And banks managed to lose that in one day's trading. As Jamie Dimon from the Fortress Bank, actually, I'd rather see it become the Fraudless Bank and not just the Fortress Bank, has proved just a couple of years ago. So the whole system is a joke, backed by none other than the poor, long-suffering taxpayer who has no word to say in it. All of these things point to only one conclusion, and that is that these banks that are too big to fail should be dismantled, broken up, and made into units that are sufficiently small that if any one of them actually failed, there wouldn't be a shock to the system. In fact, there wouldn't even be a shock to AIG because they could afford to cover it with themselves and their reinsurers. And anything that is bigger than that should not be allowed to exist. And it is indeed nothing more than a mechanism, another bailout mechanism, which the banks are engineering for themselves to protect themselves against their own incompetence, indifference, or lack of investment in proper security systems. Now, there's another aspect which you haven't touched on, which I find deeply alarming as well, is there is absolutely no doubt that cyber attacks are the way of the future. If we look at Assange, he's maybe and Snowden, they've basically done cyber attacks. And it is the modern form of warfare. Now, there's a doctrine being pushed forward which says that a country, the US, can now react militarily to a cyber attack. So you may suddenly find yourself waking up one morning and finding that someone is dropping bombs in a country you probably even never heard of, or maybe a country even near you, saying, oh, well, last night we had a cyber attack, so we've decided to launch a few cruise missiles against, let's say, Canada, because they discovered the person who made the attack was sitting in Alberta, for example. And then what is the proof of this? I mean, again, you know, we're not even capable of being honest about what happened to the downing of an airliner. And yet at the same time, the same people who are orchestrating this kind of control over the world are saying we can launch military aggression against a country because they happen to have someone with a website or who made an access, a cyber attack from wherever it was. It is really, I think the risk is very, very real. I mean, if you look at, if you were able, for example, to get into the American defense system and neutralize their attack codes, if that's how it works, then that would be much better than having the biggest nuclear armaments capability in the world. So it's a very important tool of warfare these days, that is for sure. But there's no control, once again, over the abuse of it.
That, to me, really is the heart of this. It really is the overriding concern, because unfortunately, as we've seen in so many events in the past, including September 11th, the anniversary coming up just 24 hours from now, as we've seen so many times, it is possible, obviously, to stage various incidents in order to blame on enemies. How much easier is it to do in the cyber arena, where we literally have no access to any sort of data other than what is shared to us by the authorities? So, again, they could say that it came from anywhere in the world for any reason, and as you say, the doctrine is in place to respond militarily to these types of attacks. So it is really just a green light for whatever nefarious powers may be in control of the apparatus of the U.S. military machinery to use that and to cry wolf and to say that they were attacked and when they weren't. And again, who will ever have oversight over that? Anyone who thinks that that is compatible with some idea of representative democracy or whatever people want to believe is the ruling principle of government these days, I think is naive, hopelessly so. So I, for one, am very concerned about that. And as we already know from some people who have talked to people like Richard Clark, there already is an iPatriot Act on the books waiting for the next big cyber terror event. We've talked about that many, many times in the past, but it's good to put that on the record again, because it is good to keep in mind that when these big spectacular terror events take place, and the big spectacular legislation taking away all your rights appears within a matter of weeks, that wasn't written on the spot. It was already on the shelf, just as the Patriot Act itself was. So, lots to keep in mind with regards to that. Anything else you want to add on the cyber terror meme?
Well, it is just what we're talking about is an electronic Bay of Tonkin, nothing more or less. And all you need to have is someone, you know, let's say you launch you launch a missile and it goes out of control and crashes where it shouldn't, and you say, well, you know, our systems were hacked and it was crashed, and we know it was Russia, as America is only too delighted to say, because you have to have the bogeyman. So they've been reinstated as bogeyman, and there are enough naive Americans and probably people around the world to swallow the thing hook, line, and sinker. It may well be the Russian, could well be the Russians, but there is no link between the rubbish that appears in the mainstream media, which is designed to propagandize and influence people, and the detailed analysis which is presented to explain what did actually happen to justify it. The detailed analysis no longer exists in today's world. It's all propaganda, nothing else.
And we should also note that in last month's hacking attack, if it even did take place, again, we have no direct access to it, but it was quickly blamed on the Russians, and that was endlessly repeated in the headlines of all the stories. But all of those stories eventually go on to note in the 11th paragraph or thereabouts that all the evidence pointing to Russia is circumstantial. So, again, we have no idea if the attacks even take place, and if they do, where they're coming from, yet we are expected to just go along with whatever the propaganda narrative is. So, again, a very worrying aspect. And something that I have no doubt we'll be talking about again in the future, unfortunately. David Smith, I want to wrap things up because it is about that time, but I was just talking to a regular listener to this program today who lamented the fact that it is always so unrelentingly depressing listening to us go through all of these aspects of the propaganda narrative. So I ask you today to leave us with a happy, positive note. Something good, something on the radar that's going to change humanity for the better.
That's a very good question. I actually think that what we do is of itself an immensely positive. I mean, you have a substantial audience. We talk about all kinds of things which inform and make people aware. Some of it's not very nice to hear, but the essential of it is that there is genuine communication. And if it weren't for the internet, if it weren't for people like you and me, we would all be sitting there reading the mainstream media, watching feverishly things like CNN, CNBC, and all the rest of these propagandized machines, which are actually in their death throes. I mean, you are looking at viewership figures, which are as low as they were when 30 years ago. So we are actually winning. The educated people of the world have to live in a parallel universe, because the mainstream media is designed to make sure that you cannot inform yourself and that they are slaves of the system. So I think that is a very major aspect that we should be immensely positive about, and we should fight to make sure, above all else, that this means of communications continues to exist. And it is provided pretty much free of charge. In the UK, you know, you got to pay subscriptions to get the BBC. Now, much of what the BBC does is good, but why should you be paying money to get propagandized? You cannot. Here, you can be propagandized by Mr. Smith once a month, or by Mr. Corbett more regularly, or you can choose not to bother. So I think that's very positive. And perhaps just on a lighter note, I'll finish with a rather amusing story about the Scottish elections. And it's a story about Snow White. And of course, Snow White, as you know, looks after the seven dwarfs and makes them their tea and coffee in the morning and their sandwiches, etc. And one day there's a terrible accident at the mine. And so Snow White rushes up to try and save save the dwarves. She goes down the mine shaft and she starts, hello, hello, hello. And eventually she hears a voice that says, vote Alex Salmond. And Snow White breathes a huge sigh of relief and says, oh, thank God, Dopey is still alive.
All right, excellent. All right, well, thank you so much. And thank you for articulating those thoughts. Obviously, I agree. We are breaking the tools of propaganda right in the face of the propaganda tyrants. And I think that is notable and valuable in and of itself. And the secondary effect, of course, we're letting people know out there who see through the propaganda similarly to us that they are not crazy and they are not alone, which is another important part of the social proof of the what's going on the internet right now and the fact that people can communicate these ideas. It is important what we're doing, so let's continue to do it. David L. Smith will wrap things up there and direct people once again to GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com, which, as always, will be linked up in the show notes for this interview, along with all of the other articles that we've cited today. David Smith, thank you again for your time.
Pleasure as always. Thanks a lot, and see you next month.